Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear once again from Jerry Beckley from the band America. Last week we heard about his new album. This week, collaborating with John Waters, Robert Lamb from Chicago, Carl Wilson from the Beach Boys, he being one of the voices of the Chipmunks, we'll even hear about America.
I want to be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
We're going to start in conversation with Leslie Odom Jr. You may know him from Hamilton or Rent, maybe Law & Order or CSI or in Harriet in theaters now. Leslie Odom Jr. will be in Riverside soon for a benefit performance. More on that later in the program. I want to hit the actual true beginning. I mean, that starts us off in Philly, but you were born in New York but raised in Philadelphia?
Born in New York, yeah. Born in Queens. Both my parents are native New Yorkers. My dad from the city, my mom from upstate a little bit. Yeah, born in Flushing. Lived for a bit in Astoria, and then when my folks wanted to buy a house and kind of, you know, become adults in that way, they moved to Philly where you could afford a house even back then.
That gets a lot of folks out of New York and into Philadelphia, the desire to actually own, not rent.
Yeah. My parents, I think they said their first house was like $30,000.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. That is just absurdly astounding. I remember one of our early houses cost something like $48,000. No, that's what we sold it for in 77.
Wow.
Well, I know that Philadelphia is just rich with arts-related programs and incentives and even schools for the performing arts. Did you go to one of these specialty schools, or were you public school all the way?
I was public school, and this was also a time, breaks my heart that kids don't have the same opportunity now, but it was a time where even in public school, I got a really wonderful music education just at my public school. I was in the choir, and I was in the jazz band as the vocalist, and I was taking violin and trombone, you know, a very poor student, but I was getting these, you know, these lessons and this exposure to the arts. I started going to Freedom Theater, which was a sort of a culturally specific African-American owned institution in Philadelphia. That was my first theater training, and Philadelphia Dance Company was my first dance training. And yeah, I came up at a really wonderful time in Philadelphia where, you know, my foundation, I think Philly laid a really wonderful foundation for me as far as my taste and my eye was formed there, but really a foundation of technique and training and craft is what I'm trying to get at. You know, that my early training was really about process.
Sure. I am a recovering theater geek, so some of the language that comes across here will work for me. So you actually started more on the musical side of it as opposed to the acting roles. I was an actor that ended up in Bye Bye Birdie, not a singer that hoped to do, you know, a straight play someday. So what about you then? It was music then before other acting roles.
Yeah, I was a singer in church and weekend R&B singer who ended up in Bye Bye Birdie as well. Yeah, I played Conrad Birdie in the 11th grade.
Oh, sweet.
And kind of, I wouldn't say I never looked back, but it, you know, it was a natural fit, you know, like the fact that I got to sing and sort of be theatrical guy. But it was really the show Rent, the Broadway show Rent, when it came out that sort of showed me a new world, opened up my eyes to a whole new world of Broadway and musicals. And that show was very special and specific because it was really what Jonathan Larson was doing with that show, was trying to make contemporary music work on the Broadway stage, you know, rock music, pop music. And it obviously was very attractive to me as a listener, you know, as an audience member. And so it was Rent that opened my eyes to Broadway and that being a thing that I could maybe do for a living, strive to do for a living.
Okay. I did read that you were only 17 when you ended up in Rent. Is that fact or fiction there?
I was 17.
Oh
yeah, I didn't mean for that to happen. I went to the audition when I was 16, and I was getting the callbacks. You know, they would call me back to come and keep showing up and learn more material and do more material with that. But I thought maybe at the end of the process that your picture goes into a filing cabinet and they call you someday when you're old enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, they call you when you're 25, and when you're 30 years old, you get a call and you're like, hey, we remember you from when you auditioned when you were 16. Now we have a, you know, now you're old enough. Now we can offer you a position. So that's what I was hoping for when I got the call a couple weeks after my 17th birthday. You could have knocked me over with a feather. I was shocked.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, because we were just doing the math here. So, gosh, if you were doing Bye Bye Birdie around 11th grade, this would be close to the same age that you would have been off. So you went from a high school or community theater production to Broadway. There was no
I
long,
did.
arduous process.
That's exactly right. Well, listen, you know, it was over 10 years before I stepped on a Broadway stage again. So, you know, the arduous process comes when it comes. You know, for some
Okay.
people, you get that early success and then you pay your dues later. But yeah, I did. I did. I went from the community theater from my high school stage to the Broadway stage. And I love when you ask it like that because I had the most profound experience doing that.
Oh,
And
yeah.
that I realized that there was no difference. Nothing changed. Like, you don't get sprinkled with, you know, pixie dust as you enter the Broadway stage door. It's like I was doing the same thing on a Broadway stage as I was doing on the high school stage, on the community theater stage. You know, do you know what I mean? I mean, fundamentally,
Wow.
the only thing that changed was the venue. And so it was just a profound experience, I guess, about integrity, that you're going to do your best work wherever you are, because it's not as if great habits or integrity shows up just because the gig changes, you know.
Oh my God, that's a beautiful point. You can have some of the best actors in the world that you will only see in community theater, and then the
Amen.
biggest divas end up on stage.
Amen. It's very true.
Oh,
Yeah.
that's a.
It happens with singers too, you know, that you'll travel, you end up in some small seedy nightclub, and you're like, why doesn't the world know about this person? Jesus, you know, but people are doing the great work wherever they are. You know, sometimes it's family situation, or, you know, sometimes people's goals are different. It's like, yeah, I could do that, but that's not, I'm where I want to be.
Nice. We've already addressed this one almost accidentally, but because I had this laid out to ask, so what was the path then leading from your early days to Rent? But Rent was in your early days. And so that's just absurdly cool, I have to say. Now, what blew me away, though, is that with the wonderful success of Rent, you did Rent and then you went to school, a great school. We're talking about Chicago, Carnegie Mellon. But my gosh, I mean, people with a taste of success like that, I would almost imagine not even considering school and just going on to the next audition if after Rent you even needed auditions. You know what I'm saying there?
I do, yeah. I really found there was a, he was a young cat then, you know, this guy Michael McElroy, not a name that, unless you're, you know, a real Broadway aficionado, you
Yeah,
might not know him. Tony nominated actor, but I did a bunch of Broadway shows. But Michael was not even 30 at the time. So I'm 17. I show up, you know, I'm looking at the bios, I'm looking for role models and heroes, you know, and how do you sustain a career in the arts? And Michael was a guy, he wasn't even 30. You know, black guy, beautiful singer and actor and stuff. And he had done five or six Broadway shows. And Michael went to Carnegie Mellon University. And so I went to Carnegie Mellon University because I was going to be Michael McElroy. Quite frankly, you
Cool,
know,
cool.
I just thought he was the standard. He was the gold standard. And I wanted to do it just like he did it. I was 17, you know, so
Gotcha,
I was
right.
just like, I'm going to go where he went. And I did. And somewhere along the way, and it really was, you talk about process, it really was a process wrapping my mind around the fact that I was not going to graduate Carnegie Mellon University and be Michael McElroy. You know, somewhere along the way, I figured out, oh, they're here to teach me how to be the best version of Leslie. They're here to teach me how to be a better version of myself. But I really showed up there thinking it was finishing school and kind of like everybody comes out with the same skills, knowing how to do the same things, and that's not quite how it works.
That's a wake-up call, but that sounds
Yeah.
more like the young lady or man who they were always the starring role in the community theater, and suddenly they get to college and they're no longer the automatic star every time. That's, wow, what a shock. You mentioned something that I found very interesting, and going from one stage to another, when you ended up on Broadway, it was all the same. I mean, all of the little things, which are actually, I suppose, the big things, but things like, you know, showing up early. If call time is at 8 a.m., good, you get there at 7:30, that kind of thing. Listen to the stage manager. He or she is God for all practical purposes for the performance. That kind of thing. So what about things that really blew you away? I guess it really surprised you that so much was the same. How about something that was drastically different once you hit the Broadway stage? Or again, is it just that was the surprise, not much different?
No, I tell you what was shocking too. You know, when I got to rent, you know, bright-eyed, bushy, couldn't have been more bushy-tailed, 17-year-old kid, you know, and I show up with some people who have by that time already been in the show for 3.5, 4 years. There's some people, quite frankly, who never worked again. You know, there were some people like, it was very much my first stop. There were some people, it was very much their last stop. And so a rude awakening for me was like that we weren't all hanging out at each other's houses at night, that we weren't all going out, you know, for lunch in between shows. It was the nuts and bolts of it that I was a kid and these were adults. These were people that had lives and, you know, it wasn't like the community theater or like the high school show. We put up the show together and it bonds us together and we, you know, we're hanging out. Best summer of my life. You know what I mean? Like, it was very much not that. People were like, settle down, get the kid out of my face. You know what I mean? Can you turn the 17 down a little bit? So that really was, I, if I'm being honest, you know, that really was sort of a heartbreaking metamorphosis that I had to, you know, go through to realize that it's like, okay, I'm in the professional world now and people are not showing up quite as bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as I.
And this would have been your summer of, it'll only be 4 more years before I can go out for drinks with the rest of the cast.
That's right.
Oh, gosh.
That's right. Yeah, I couldn't even drink. I couldn't even drink. So, like, yeah, they were not having me. This is rent, for God's sake. Yeah, they were not having me at all.
Oh, wow. One of the other just huge, huge roles for you would be that of Aaron Burr in Hamilton. But you first worked with Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda on Tick, Tick, Boom. Is this what led to Hamilton? But first, let's address Tick, Tick, Boom.
Well, Tick, Tick, Boom, for those people that are really dialed into the theater, Tick, Tick, Boom was, we just talked about Rent, Jonathan Larson's first show that he wrote was a show called Tick, Tick, Boom. And Jonathan tragically, of course, died in the previews for Rent off-Broadway. Tick, Tick, Boom was a show that he'd written about his life before Rent, and it's this little autobiographical musical that doesn't get done very often. But yeah, Lin and I were doing it off-Broadway here in New York City. And Lin, full circle, is now directing a television version of that for Netflix.
Okay.
Tick, Tick, Boom really wasn't even how we found each other. You know, in a roundabout way, Smash ended up being good for something. Smash was this television show on NBC that was very, very polarizing. But it did put me in the faces of more people than I'd ever been in before and really introduced me in a way that I'd never been introduced before. And so I ended up getting an email asking me to be a part of early developmental readings of Hamilton, the Hamilton mixtape, as it was called. And I just held on for dear life until we got to Broadway.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because on your bio, it says you originated the role of Aaron Burr. And so some folks could easily just read that and go, oh, he was cast in it. This is much more than that. Talk to me about origination of the character, because you were really the earliest readings and development.
Yeah, well, part of the whole thing in New York is, you know, by the time you're seeing something on a Broadway stage, anything that's worthwhile, most of the time, I mean, those things have been in development for 5 or 6 or 7 years or longer. The normal gestation really is about 5, 6 years. So there were years of readings of Hamilton where Lin would write 3 or 4 more songs and then he'd get a group of actors together so he could hear it. And you learn the songs and you perform them and then you go away for 4 or 5 months and then you'd get another call. Okay, I wrote 4 more songs. Mm-hmm. Can we get together? You know, okay. And it's just, that's the process. And if you've been around as I had by then, you know, so this is like probably almost 15 years since I've been on Broadway with Rent. There was one show in between, but we won't speak of it. But yeah, you know, it's been a while since I've been on a Broadway stage. So you know when you get a piece of material like Hamilton, people ask me, you know, did you know? Listen, I didn't know that it would connect with America the way that it did. I didn't know that its reach would be so broad, but I knew the way I felt about it. I knew that it was the freshest, most literate, most exciting piece of original material that I'd ever been given, and that was enough. That was enough for me to turn down work and to make sure that I stayed close to it.
That's really beautiful. So much of us would be looking at it in retrospective, in that, you know, airs this thing on Broadway, or for my niece who just went nuts over Hamilton, even bought that 5-inch thick book and read it cover to cover. We're looking in retrospect, but for you, it's just a series of 18 packs of cigarettes around a smoky room at a table doing more and more reads and just more secondhand smoke than development on a script. But this was it all finally together before you saw this thing that spoke to you? Or was it, you know, amongst the first couple of table reads with the clipboards and the pencils and the frustrations and all that, that you were seeing, I'm really hoping this becomes something?
Oh, no, I'm 20 seconds in. 20 seconds in. 20 seconds into that first number. You know, there'll be listeners of yours that have yet to listen to Hamilton. You can imagine there's still people that have yet to listen to it, which is fine. You know, it's like you get around to it when you get around to it. But 20, 25 seconds into that first song,
wow,
you know this is not like anything you've ever heard before. It's so smart. It's so smart. And when something as an actor coming from this fabulous and thorough training that I got at Carnegie Mellon University, where we're training with Molière and Shakespeare, yeah, and Thomas Wilson, and, you know, we're training Tennessee with the classics, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you get out of school and it doesn't take you long before you realize, oh, okay, you know, most of the industry is like, you know, you're doing vampire shows on the CW.
Yep.
You know, you're not doing, you ain't doing the classics. Not if you want to make a living. And yeah, so for Lynn to give us a contemporary piece of theater that was like, that was sturdy and muscular and required something of you physically and mentally and emotionally, it's like, man, there's nowhere else to be, nowhere you'd rather be.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Later in the program, we'll hear once again from Jerry Beckley of the band America. First, though, back to Leslie Odom Jr., performing at the Fox Performing Arts Center in Riverside December 19th, presented by Fox Riverside Theater Foundation and Operation Safe House. Leaving Broadway, and let's look at the big screen, Murder on the Orient Express. An incredible retelling, but what was this movie for you, as in a chance to do a period piece, off-Broadway that is, like Hamilton wasn't a period piece, but or maybe a chance to work with Kenneth Branagh, Willem Dafoe, some of these other folks. What was Murder on the Orient Express for you as an actor?
The chance to learn, you know, the chance to work with Branagh. And I was at the moment, you know, trying to branch out from the stage, trying to take that next step into whatever the world held. And there's nobody that's done that better than Branagh. He stepped right off of the stage in Hamlet, Henry the whatever, and, you know, went to the movies and went to television and started directing. And so I just wanted to learn from him, and he put together a tremendous ensemble, and that led to a few other movies. Harriet was also this year, Sopranos, Sopranos prequel next year. So
Film
has been interesting, but the pivot that I was most interested in, I think, you know, when you have some success in the entertainment industry, you get a chip, and where you decide to play that chip is really important. You can't stay in Hamilton forever. You got to turn it into something. Music was really where I decided to pivot, and so we put out an album of jazz standards, a Christmas album that was tremendously successful for us, and then really the next frontier was the original album. That was the next logical step. I started telling people 3 years ago that I was going to make this album of original music before I'd written a single song, but I knew that it was the next logical step, and so it's here. It came out November the 8th. The response has been amazing. I'm so, so proud of it. Like Hamilton, there'll be, I imagine, lots and lots of your listeners that have yet to hear it. That's okay by me.
Sure.
You know, I hope people will give it a chance.
This is the one called Mister?
That's right. If I'm known at all as a singer, it's like it's primarily from the Broadway tunes or nationwide jingles or, you know, the Christmas album, jazz album. But this is the first time that I'm singing my own melodies, my own lyrics. A lot of these songs started as journal entries. And so it's a deeply personal project, and I'm very, very proud of it.
Nice. Let's address that. You were on the cast recording of Hamilton. But as far as putting out an album or CD under your name, we sort of spoke about when the idea started to come about, but what made this go from an idea, something that you'd like to do, to actually making it a reality?
If you're lucky enough, you know, you need a partner, somebody you can build with, whether that's a dear friend or just a business partner or a romantic partner. You know, for me, it's turned into a friend and a brother. I met a guy named Joseph Abate who said he wanted to make a record with me. And this is right after Smash. So it was before Hamilton and all that stuff. And he said, go to Kickstarter and raise his money. And I was super sort of prideful about that. I'm
right.
Like, I don't want to go and ask people for money, you know. And he had a lot of reasons why he thought we should do it. He was absolutely right. You know, what I learned through that process, through crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, was that really you're essentially asking your friends and your family. Those are the people that are responding the most. There were some strangers for sure, but mostly it was people that it was my middle school teachers and elementary school friends on Facebook and my family and, you know, people that I'd worked with who gave me increments of, you know, 15, 20 bucks at a time. We raised $40,000 and we recorded that initial album. And fast forward to Mister, there is no Mister without that original album. Essentially, my family and friends gave me my first record deal. And again, even and the same as Hamilton, you know, it's all about, okay, what are you going to turn that into? And what are you going to turn that into? And so that $40,000 investment has gotten us to where we are today.
So these are all original pieces then on the new one?
Every single one, yes. There's 11 original songs on this album. We wrote about 25 tunes. These are the best 11. My main collaborator was this guy, Rafael Casal, who's just a genius and a friend of mine. My producers were Theron Nephew Feimster and Joseph Abate, the guys as mentioned. We're still working together. And so it was just an incredible collaboration and the artistic experience of my life, which is saying something considering all the wonderful things I've gotten to be a part of. But I'm just so pleased with it. And I would like the chance to do better. You know, I'd like to record another album. But, you know, I think it's saying something when you can point to something and say, yeah, that comes pretty damn close to the way we intended it to sound, that it's fully realized, and I hope people will give it a listen.
Nice. What little exposure I've had to it so far, It Go Crazy, for example, I've checked that one out. You can find that on YouTube. But at a glance, you know, you see Go Crazy and Under Pressure, it sounds like you're covering Prince and Queen. So I'm not kidding. That's what I saw and that's what I thought. But then, so I'm so glad that I saw this. And you mentioned that these were, a lot of them started off as journal entries. Was it until you went into the recording studio that some of these ended up being realized as songs, or was that step already taken?
Yeah, no, we did a little writer's camp, you know, where I got, just for expedience's sake, to be honest, you know, because you can have writing sessions for years and years. You've got to fly to this place and fly to that place and meet this person. So we just got everybody together for a few days up in San Francisco. We were at the Skywalker Ranch.
Oh, cool.
And we wrote these tunes. 89% of what you hear on the record was written at that little camp up at Skywalker.
Oh, way cool. Way cool. Yeah. Let's go back just a bit to some of the movies and some TV. Well, Harriet specifically, this one just out for the public. Folks may not have seen this yet, but this is a big, big show. Please talk to us about your involvement in this and how this came about for you. Was this something an agent called you for? They loved you on CSI. Whatever the case is.
No, it happened in a really organic and simple way. Harriet, of course, tells the story of Harriet Tubman. Mm-hmm. I played William Still in the movie. He was sometimes referred to as the father of the Underground Railroad. He really was kind of the last stop in the North if you were lucky enough and courageous enough to make it all the way to his doorstep. He would get you set up and get you a job and get you a place to stay in Philadelphia once you arrive. But Harriet is about her. It's about her story. And I, on the Tony night, on the night that I was fortunate enough to have my name called on that night, a dear friend of mine had her name called. Her name is Cynthia Rebo. We had become really, really close. Cynthia is actually the godmother to our daughter. So we're very close. We're family. And Cynthia got this role of Harriet Tubman, and she wanted me to be her William Still. so I was happy to oblige. I knew about William and his work with the Underground Railroad from growing up in Philadelphia. I had heard the name and I knew about his life's work. My main job getting ready for the film was to fill in everything I didn't know, which was like his family stuff, you know, who his parents were, siblings, all that kind of stuff. So it was great fun, great education. I really loved making it.
As far as you preparing for something like William Still, you know, you just mentioned reading about his family and this, that, and the other. So many folks might approach it simply with, here are the lines. You know, this is the David Mamet approach. The lines are there, okay? Just do it.
But I love that book, by the way.
Oh, wow, cool, cool. Oh, yeah, I have a lot to say on that one, but we'll save that one for some drinks someday. But that one, Alec Baldwin, I agree with almost nothing in this book. I highly recommend it. This is one of the things on that book, True and False.
Yeah.
So in reading something about Still's father, or maybe what he experienced in high school, or whatever it is that you might have read about him, can you think of anything that really shaped and really changed the character for you of playing William Still, had you not done this additional research?
Yeah, it helped me locate an engine for the guy, helped me locate a reason why he might have sacrificed so much. It's, and then, you know, if nothing else, it's just interesting, you know, a guy who never spent a day of his life in chattel slavery like any of us. You know, you look at somebody's thrust in their life, you look at the wonderful things that they do in their life or the awful things they do with their life and just kind of judge them based on that. But if you care to learn, if you care to learn about where somebody's coming from, it helps the empathy, it helps you understand. And so William, while he was born in New Jersey, he was raised by two escaped slaves. His mother and his father escaped at different times. And his mother was faced with the impossible decision at a certain point after two failed escape attempts with her four children. She was faced with the impossible decision. She left two of her kids behind. She left her two boys behind and she escaped with her two girls. And so I just imagine.
My gosh.
Yeah, I just imagine a guy who must have been raised by a woman who was grieving for the rest of her life. You know, on some level, there was some part of her that he couldn't access. There was some part of her that he never understood. I imagine, did he hear about it from a sibling? You know, growing up in a black family the way that I did, I know about the things that don't get spoken about. The things you learn about once you're an adult. And you're like, wait, I never knew that. Oh, so that's why grandma was like that. Or that's why auntie was afraid to go near the stove. You know what I mean? You learn these things later. And so just imagining that part of him, you know, what a huge thing that is. What a huge thing that must have been for him. Yeah, that just helped me locate, as I said, just a possible engine for him, something that kept him striving past the defeat, past any kind of obstacle put in his path.
That's fantastic. So many of us as an actor, you get these internals. And I truly believe that if you do that kind of research that we were just talking about, if you know about auntie or the mother or whatever, this gives you a drive inside. And, you know, maybe it's nothing that somebody physically sees other than a glimmer in the eye if you're in an intimate stage. But I feel like if you, the actor, feels it, then something else will come out.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
I know it.
We mentioned auditioning just a little bit ago. When did it get to the point for you, by the way, that you weren't going to cattle calls anymore, but rather an agent calling you and saying, hey, here's something good? When was this transition for you, and when did you realize it, I guess? That's the real thrust, I suppose, is when did you realize that you didn't have to do the cattle calls anymore?
I think all of our lives changed after Hamilton. I think any of my cast members would tell you the same thing. All of our lives changed. We were just, for a short time, you know, felt like if you were on stage at the Richard Rodgers Theater, you were at the center of the whole universe.
And yep.
I've spoken to other actors that have been part of phenomena, cast members from the original Rent, for instance, or Christine Baranski, actually, you know, she did an original Tom Stoppard play. She said it's like a trip to Paris on the Concorde. You know, that's the way she described it. I mean, yeah, it really is. You really do feel like you're just where it's at. And so, post-Hamilton, there were phone calls and opportunities that I never, ever in my life. Film, for instance, I couldn't get arrested. You know, I mean, nobody was hiring me for a movie. Yeah. So the fact that I get to do that, the fact that I get to make these albums, is a dream come true. And to me, I look at it as the Tony Award for me, mm-hmm. that acknowledgement, or the way I treat it is like, that's my industry giving me a chance. Of what I'm trying to say is, you know, I'm trying to make those people proud. You know, people voted for me for that. I'm trying to make good on the opportunity that they gave me by singling me out in that way. That's what those moments are. And I think my castmates would say the same thing. I saw Renee last night in a wonderful movie called Waves. I was texting with her. Yeah. Anthony Ramos put out a beautiful album this year. David Diggs put out an incredible, formidable piece of writing this year with the latest Clipping album. Lynn continues to break new ground. And so that's what we're all trying to do. I think we're all trying to go, okay, you know, world, thank you for loving us up and for opening your arms to us. And we just want to keep making you proud.
Nice. I never saw Smash, so I'm just going to skip right to Dick Wolf Productions. And you have a recurring role as Reverend Curtis on Law & Order SVU. And so on SVU, when you first held the role, was there any indication that it would be a recurring role, that you would be called back? Or was it a successful story arc? How did they handle that as far as calling somebody back for a recurring role?
That goes back to, you know, at a certain point, you get these opportunities, and if you do the right thing with them, you make relationships, you build relationships. And Warren Light is the showrunner at SVU. He was when I was on the show. He's back now. He left for a little bit. He's back. And the Broadway show that we skipped right by earlier, I did a show right after Smash called Leap of Faith.
Oh, yeah, right.
And we did 23 whole shows in New York City. We ran for 2.5 weeks, and Warren Light wrote that show. And so I spent a great deal of time with Warren, and we became friends and admirers of one another. And Warren wrote that role for me with the intention that I would become a small part of the Law & Order SVU family. And I'm very, very grateful. When we were off Broadway with Hamilton, man, what a blessing that show was when I was making $800 a week in New York City before agents, before managers, before taxes. So that ended up being around $400 a week when all was said and done. And I was a married man. You know? I am a married man. You know, so trying to support a family in New York City on $400 a week is not easy.
No.
But Law & Order SVU, whenever they would call, man, the way that that would alleviate some stress in my life, it was a little bit of oxygen, a little bit of breathing room. So I'm very grateful for it.
Way cool. Folks would have only seen your role and maybe not thought of the past presentation of the character, but since it was 7 or 8 times the Reverend has been on SVU so far, did you ever encounter anything that maybe was in conflict with an earlier portrayal of the character? Like, oh my gosh, he wouldn't trust this person, yet now he's open arms with the police or anything like that. Any kind of, I don't want to say like errors in continuity because you want to maybe get hired again. So I'm looking at more character development than anything like that.
I didn't. I mean, I never found any of that stuff, any kind of inconsistency. I mean, they've been doing that show. It's a record-breaking show. It's season 21, season 22. I mean, it's a well-oiled machine over there. And I'll tell you, you don't make it to season 21 or 22 because you're having an awful time. They have a wonderful time. They love each other. They love their jobs. They're grateful to have a long run in New York City. You know, there's people that have put their kids through college on that show and bought houses. So that Law & Order set is a really, really unique thing.
I would think, and you know, and I'll skip over everything about CSI and everything else, but just sticking with SVU, any stories about SVU where maybe you found out that Ice-T was such a crack-up, or instances where folks are just joking around so much and then, boom, you have to be on camera for a very serious moment.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this for the fans of the show. You know, Mariska is the best number one I've ever seen. The best number one on a call sheet I've ever seen. There's not a lot of jobs in America anymore the last 21 years. My grandfather retired from the factory, I think, after 33, 34 years. But that's a really rare thing these days. You know, most of us, you know, we have lots and lots of jobs that we do for shorter periods of time. Mariska's been doing that job for 21 years. And you might have the idea that she's phoning it in at some point, or like, you know, or that
Never.
She doesn't really care season 20, season, you know. When I tell you, I've never seen anybody care more.
Wow.
I've never seen it. She is completely dialed in. She's completely passionate. And the only thing I can really attribute it to is like the same thing that I found with Aaron Burr, the same thing that I found, you know, with feeling like this was what I was meant to be doing with my life. I think she found that with Detective Benson.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I think she's like, you know, square hole, square peg. Like, this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. I feel useful here. I feel like I am using myself to my fullest potential. She directs now on the show, and she's amazing. The best number one I've ever seen.
She's just fantastic. Just absolutely amazing. And yes, I have been a fan of the show since, I guess, since the inception. I started with Law & Order, then there was SVU, and there was Criminal Intent, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, well, let's kind of wrap with talking about the main thrust of this phone call. We're talking about, for Riverside, California, the Fox Foundation and Operation Safe House, helping at-risk youth and also helping mentor kids on stage. Did you have any connection to this organization?
Yeah, we have a dear family friend. We have a dear family friend, Amy, who's, you know, this is her life's work. This is her passion. And she said to me a year and a half ago, she said she wanted to do this thing and would I be interested and would I lower my fee to do it? I said, of course. You know, number one, I respect Amy so much and I respect her, you know, her heart and her taste. But yeah, when she described to me what the organization was about, how could I say no? So I'm so excited to come. We have a great show planned, a holiday show. We're going to definitely sing all your favorites. We'll sing Hamilton stuff from the album, holiday classics. That's going to be a ball. I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. On your first self-titled CD, you mentioned jazz standards. And in addition to my various many other geekdoms, jazz is also one of them. Any non-holiday standards that we can look forward to coming up in Riverside soon?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I am not quite finished putting the set list together yet. But yeah, we try to make a fully like satisfying experience. We want people to leave with a smile on their faces. And so like, I assure you, buying tickets to the show, you're not going to be disappointed. If you happen to be a fan of anything done, you're going to hear something in this concert that you love. So bring the whole family. Come on out. It's going to be a ball.
That's fantastic. This was really nice.
My pleasure. Can't wait to listen.
David Fleming in conversation with actor and singer Leslie Odom Jr. Fox Riverside Theater Foundation and Operation Safe House will host an evening with Leslie Odom Jr. on Thursday, December 19th at 6 p.m. at the Fox Performing Arts Center in Riverside. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. On last week's KVC Arts, we heard from Jerry Beckley from the band America, though we heard mainly about his new solo release. Now, what we didn't have time for last week. Collaborations with David Cassidy, Beckley being one of the voices for the Chipmunks, and how he started with music, on the piano at a very young age, though it wasn't because he was asking for lessons, or even that his parents decided to have him take lessons.
Because the house that we were renting outside of London was furnished, and it was furnished with a piano. So I just started fiddling around, and my mom, who is still with us, she's 97, was and is a fanatic of basically classical music, and leaned towards the Russians, the Rachmaninoffs and Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev and stuff. So there was some really pretty high-class stuff flying through the air anyway on the old hi-fi. And the piano just gave me a chance to kind of just start messing around. And she was focused enough to say, he appears interested. So got lessons, I think, from about 4, and I took lessons till I was about 10. And I was a reader at that time, but I always played by ear anyway. And unfortunately, most of the reading training kind of waned over the years, although I still know what I'm looking at, but I can't just sight read and play. And then I took up guitar around 9 or 10, so kind of kept them both going.
Okay. And I thought it was really cool. I read that you were, by 1962 or so, playing guitar in an instrumental surf rock band, the Vanguards. But then I did the math and realized you were only around 10 at this time. So what kind of a band was it?
Yeah, right when I got my first guitar, my brother was a fan of the Kingston Trio, and he had an acoustic, and he sawed off the top, turning it into a four-string, basically a tenor guitar. So he sawed off the top, too, because, you know, that guy in the Kingston Trio had a tenor guitar. And so that was kind of the first instrument around the house. And then I talked my folks into buying me a Silvertone electric. And the surf music had started by that time. And that was just that year or two. I guess around Beach Boys was about the same time. But all the Venture stuff. You didn't have to sing, is my point. You could just be a surf guitarist. And so that's what the Vanguards was.
Excellent. Okay. You were a military brat growing up, or is this just, you know, during your high school?
Yeah, Air Force. All three of us founding members, our dads were in the Air Force, and that's how we met. We were all stationed at the same base outside of London in the mid-60s.
You and Dewey and Dan Peek.
I was a child of the 60s, so unsure of my direction. I would follow where my friends and family would lead. I was strengthened by the birth of the Beatles, sparked by inspiration.
In addition to America, I read only recently of the wide variety of other collaborations that you've had with Carl Wilson. You mentioned the Beach Boys just a second ago. That was, what, Like a Brother, I believe? This was, I know we're jumping a bunch of years here, but believe me, we'll be going back. But Like a Brother in 2001, how did this come about, you working with Carl Wilson?
Well, the Like a Brother album was something called Beckley Lamb Wilson, and it was myself and Robert Lamb from the group Chicago and Carl.
Okay.
And I think the actual official story is that Robert Lamb was already doing a few solo albums. He had had a couple under his belt. And I knew Robert, and he wanted to cut a song of mine called Watching the Time Go By. And he asked if that particular album Phil Ramone was producing. And either he or Phil said, well, let's get some of your buddies in. Let's get maybe Jerry and Carl to sing. And we sang on that track. And we had a great time. And, of course, a little's good, a lot's better. We ought to make a record of this. And the three of us, you know, from our respective bands, Beach Boys, Chicago, and America, we thought, that's a kind of a neat story. Didn't realize quite what we were fighting off, because each one of our schedules was so full that if you overlapped any two groups, there would be virtually no daylight on the calendar. And if you threw the third group on the calendar, there's absolutely no very little time. So it took us years and years to get it done, but it was a labor of love.
Gotcha. It's almost akin to a supergroup like Cream or something, you know, taking all these guys from various groups and putting it together. But that wasn't really the intention, this supergroup. It was more of an album among friends.
Yeah, and also we all came from groups that shared vocals and stuff. So the concept of it's not all on your shoulders is always appealing. The unfortunate people who follow this story, the tragic ending was that before we were finished, Carl was diagnosed with cancer, and we were almost done with the record, but we, of course, put it on hold, and he was gone within the year. So it wasn't until a year or so later that we thought, you know, let's review this. And we spoke to Gina, his widow, and who said that she knew that he would love to have this stuff available. So we mastered it, put it out, but it was clearly the most tragic of scenarios.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, as a listener, as a person who appreciates the music, I'm glad that it did come out, but yes, this very unfortunate circumstances there. A couple of other collaborations, one of which truly surprised me. Well, let's David Cassidy, first of all. Looking at the album cover, I forget which one that was, but looking at the album cover, that had to have been circa 74 or 75 or so, with the white jumpsuit and the bell bottoms.
Yeah, I did a couple things with David. He was making a very honest, sincere effort to get some credibility. I mean, he'd obviously been one of the biggest stars in the world, and that comes with all of the baggage that a journey like that includes. But he had got a new deal with RCA, and he brought in Bruce Johnson of the Beach Boys again, and Bruce was producing. And I ended up writing a bunch and singing on that album, and then he asked if I would produce the next one. So I had a couple of pretty concentrated years of working with David. Again, even back then, my real job was filling a lot of the year, so it thickened up my life quite a bit.
Gosh. Now, one of the biggest surprises as far as collaborations, John Waters. What did you do with Waters?
I did a lot of sessions when I was in town. There was a few of us, Timothy Schmidt, from the Eagles, Andrew Gold, who's the writer of Lonely Boy and Thank You for Being a Friend, and a few others. And we were doing a lot of sessions for a variety of producers as the kind of go-to singing guys. And John Boylan was producing a lot of those things. We did Muppets albums. I did a Simpsons album on one of the Chipmunks, believe it or not. But one of the things that came across was John Waters doing a movie called Crybaby with Johnny Depp, and it was Johnny's first feature film. You know, he'd had the Jump Street success. And so for John Waters, it's going to be a musical, and it was a wonderful experience, because normally if you're involved in a movie, you're singing the song or one of the songs, and they're kind of tacked on at the end, and the movie's basically already been done. But in this case, I was the voice of one of the characters, so all the music had to be done ahead of time. So I got to go to Baltimore for the filming and watch everybody work, and got to get to watch John Waters, who was just a dream. He was so great. I would have thought, my preconceived notions were totally wrong. I thought, oh, this will be just kind of sketchy and rough and a bit, you know, because I'd seen all of the art house stuff, put it mildly. And I couldn't have been more wrong. He was just so chill, and he's from Baltimore, and he always films there, and he just was so lovely. And for him to have a budget of a couple million dollars was like the deepest of pockets. He couldn't believe it, you know. So in his world, that was just like endless money. And then, you know, he had a lot of fun.
Absolutely. George Romero did the same thing. You know, all of his zombie movies were no budget, but then suddenly he did get one with the Hollywood backing. And so suddenly he had millions, where he was doing soap commercials to pay for the next scene. Well, a little bit on America. We ended up with History, America's Greatest Hits, by the time I was maybe six. But then, because of my love for that, I ended up picking up Hat Trick, a little bit out of order there. I know that was a 73 album. But that's the one that gave us Muskrat Love. And, okay, there was a little bit of a laugh there, because it didn't go very higher on the charts for you guys. But then Captain and Tennille had such a huge hit with it. So I'm sure that had to have been a shock in a way.
Patrick was a great project. It was our third record, and we were producing ourselves at the time, and we'd done well with Homecoming, the album before, which we produced, and Adventure Highway and Don't Cross the River. Patrick was a far more involved record. It took months to do. We had picked what was called Muskrat Candlelight, this kind of earthy swamp kind of tune by Willis Allen Ramsey, and it was never really meant to be featured as a feature cut. It was just going to be, we'd always liked to do a cover or two, but it got featured, and all of a sudden it was representing the band, and Captain Tennille actually thought it was our record or our song. But I suppose you can call it redemption in that they had a number one record with it. But it was after the whole Hat Trick project, and I like Hat Trick. Some of the young guys that work with us, you know, that do social media and stuff, it's their favorite album. A bit quirky, but it's kind of steered us towards George Martin, who took the reins from album 4 through 10, I think. So everything's for a reason, and the Hat Trick kind of moved us along.
Okay, well, looking at that as the project that you described it as, so Muskrat Love didn't make it for you guys. What do you think from Hat Trick should have made it? Whether it's one of the four of yours, or Green Monkey is one of my favorites, I think grossly overlooked.
Well, we still do Green Monkey sometimes on stage. I kind of joke with Du about, you know, how groups are taking on an album and say they're going to perform the, you know, like there's a bunch of people out at the moment doing the Beatles White album. It's done the Beatles, but it's a fantastic group of people, Todd Rundgren and Jason Scheff and Christopher Cross. I've always said, you know, we ought to do hat trick with a symphony. To me, the challenge would be to do the title track, which is 7 or 8 minutes long, and it's got 3 or 4 different movements. And I think it'd be fun, but for Dewey, I'm partially kind of poking, having fun, because it would be a lot of work, and it would involve that, what's that word, rehearsal. You know? So I wouldn't hold your breath.
Well, okay, I was about to leave it, but that does remind me of something from Hat Trick. There was a very gentle wind wave, which picks up about 90 seconds in with more of a percussive drive, but then as well as the string section, punching the beats, not just the violin drone, as it were, in the background, but actually hitting the beats. Real strings, I presume, in 1973?
Yeah, Jim Ed Norman, who made quite a name for himself later on, went to Nashville, I think, and became quite a successful executive. Now, I don't want to get over my skis here, but we knew of Jim Ed because he had done the strings for the Eagles on Desperado.
Mm.
And we thought, oh, and so he did some strings for us, and really lovely, wrote and conducted it. So I think now, when I think of Hat Trick, I do like to mention that Dan's track, It's Life, which I think is, my, first of all, my favorite Dan Peake song, but maybe one of my favorite America songs of all time. I just love that.
Mm, nice. Was the notion on Windwave from the onset to have a movement with strings, or maybe an epiphany kind of after the fact kind of thing?
I had written the bridge section, that dun 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 dun, yeah. And, you know, I was kind of the go-to bridge guy.
Okay.
For Dewey and maybe for Dan, too. And so it just called for, you know.
All right, nice.
Just had to be.
Cool. One more thing about America. Addressing Horse with No Name, this song, or perhaps some other one that Dewey brought in, I'm curious about your first reaction to something like this. And I say something like this because it could be, wow, this is a great allegorical kind of thing, or more of a, Dewey, what were you thinking?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to accurately tell you right when I first heard it, but we didn't like right away go, oh my God, that's the one. I do recall that. It was a very interesting tune because it was just so lyrically dense. Musically, it was just these two chords back
oh, yeah,
and forth.
Yeah. And, so basic.
And
yeah.
Stuff. And, you know, in kind of producing 101, what you do when you have somewhat of a monochromatic structure is you just build on it. You know, you don't throw every pan at it on the first. You start with one guitar, and the next time around, two guitars, whatever your techniques are. But you got to build it so that each time the verse comes around or the refrain or whatever, it just is more rewarding. It's a little thicker, a little more fulfilled. And the Horse is a great example of that. We just use some of these old kind of two-part harmony on the second chorus, three-part harmony on the third, some basic production things to give it, frankly, what really was needed, because the part of that song, I always say that the interesting thing is for having such cryptic lyrics and surreal imagery, when it comes to the chorus, la 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 la. I've seen, you know, all around the world, I've seen a bull ring in Quito, Ecuador, 15,000-20,000 people all break out in the chorus to Horse with No Name. So it truly is the universal language in that regard.
I've been speaking with Jerry Beckley of the band America. More at jerrybeckley.com and more on America, including their 50th anniversary tour at venturahighway.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KBC Arts. Thanks again to Jerry Beckley. Thanks also to Leslie Odom Jr. and getting me in touch with Odom, Amy Harrison, as well as Jordan, Joseph, and Flavio with Borderlight Entertainment. Here at KBCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KBC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kbcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year, quick and easy, at kbcrnews.org. And thanks again.